A glass of water will be right here. Session, so I'll just summarize a few basic things about meditation practice and the kind of the essence of what the approach is about. And one of the most important things is just to keep it really simple. Right, meditation is not a very complicated thing. The breath is always there, and all it really is about kind of getting to the point where you can just be aware of the breath. And a lot of the time you can't even get there, because watching the breath is actually quite a subtle kind of meditation. It's not easy. The mind has to be you have to be very mindful and have a lot of clarity before you can actually watch the breath properly. So a lot of the time it is just means you sit down and you find some kind of ease. The way that you know that your meditation has been successful is really just if you feel better when you come out than when you started. That's how you know it's been successful. If you come out the other end, you don't feel better, then you have to ask yourself why. Right? And a lot of that is just has to do with just sitting back, allowing things to be, allowing things to settle down on its own account. Remember, meditation is all about a natural process. And really what you have to do is to be patient and allow things to settle down, which of course is difficult for most people to be really patient, because we are used to doing things. We're used to organizing, we're used to sorting things out. And because of that, being patient is actually quite hard. It's a very valuable thing to learn to be patient. Just to sit back, allow things to calm down by themselves. Just observe, be the passenger on the train, right? Just seeing things flowing by. Make it very easy, very nice. And when you make it easy, then you will be able to sustain this thing. Commit yourself, continue the practice for a long time into the future. And that is when you have real results on the Buddhist path, right? When you have the sense of commitment. So to do that, you have to enjoy the practice. One of those crucial elements, to have to enjoy it, to know something that actually gives you some kind of tangible benefit in life, right here, right now. And then you will be going a long way on this path. So this is really, so it's actually very simple. So we'll just try one more time to see how things go, and then we'll come back afterwards to some more talking later on. So okay, let's see what happens. always, one more time, go back to the very beginning again then. Make sure that you are really at ease and really relaxed and that you're enjoying it. Even the very beginning of the meditation then. Just relaxing, allowing things to be, just feeling good inside of yourself then. Just doing that much is already beneficial then. So make sure that every time you sit down, you follow the procedure which works for you in this way. Whereby you relax, you feel at ease, you feel the benefits of this practice pretty much straight away. so rare to have this kind of opportunity to be in such good company, such a suitable place for meditation practice, because it is so rare. Take the opportunity now. Now is the time to do the meditation, not to think about the past or the future. Here is where you come the closest to the true meaning of life. Everything else is irrelevant by comparison. So make sure you enjoy this. Make sure you have the right attitude. And then the mindfulness will come all by itself. as you just learn to wait and be patient and find that mindfulness often arises, and when it does, just sit back, be a passenger, and just enjoy the ride and see what happens. Just have awareness of whatever comes into your awareness, and allow it to pass through. No reaction, no judgment, nothing right or wrong, just the enjoyment of what is happening right now. And see how beautiful that is. The more you get into seeing the beautiful aspect of the meditation, the more powerful it becomes. And as it becomes beautiful, the awareness strengthens. And when the awareness strengthens, often only the breath is left behind. Then just gradually allow yourself to stay with that beautiful breath and take you forward on this wonderful path. am successful with a breath meditation, that it's so important what your attitude is to the breath. To see the breath as this friend, this wonderful friend who's been so kind to you in looking after you your whole life. Now it's your turn to show the kindness back. Just allow your friend to be. Just going along with him or her and wandering forward into this marvelous adventure called meditation practice. So much beauty can happen in meditation. So allow yourself just to drift into that beauty without expectation, without any kind of force or will. better meditation practice than try to understand why things are happening. Yeah. How do you feel now? What is the reason for that? What is the perception that you have developed? What are the things that you have let go of? How does that process actually happen? As you understand that, you can take charge of your own meditation practice. You become more independent, more master of what you're doing. So let's just have a 10-minute break as usual.
I'll give you a salary for carrying the cheese. This is my salary to you. Are you ready? Okay. This is for you. Yeah. This is for you. Look, and then this is for you.
Okay.
You
can do
this one. Yeah. Salary. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay, great. I've got something for you.
Oh.
Yeah. This is two for you. Because of all your kind of hard work. Yeah. This is one for your wife.
More salary
than
my
mindfulness.
I will help you to feel a little bit more happy. Okay, thank you. Okay. Very good. Very nice to have you here. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Here are the chocolates. Or
something.
I can give you the chocolates you gave me.
No, it's nice to meet you. It's nice to have a share.
Yeah. Yeah. You mentioned about the origins of the Chan from Chan Buddhism.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if you're aware, but in the Agamas, actually, they use the word Ajahnas, actually.
Yeah.
So they use it like two times, third times. Like literally 1, 2, 3, 4, first jhana,
first time, second time.
They use it in the same exact way as well.
I think it's a transfiguration. It's not through the sound, it goes by sound, right? It's not actually a translation, it's just the divine sound for that, so it sounds like jhana. That's why sometimes it's very hard to understand the Chinese, because you have to know when it's transliterated, when it actually is translated, you know.
Yes. And for me, when I read it, sometimes it's a little bit confusing because you don't quite know when it switches.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, this is Samma Sambodhi.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, and literally it would just be like Samma Sambodhi or something like that. It would sound like that, and when you read it out, then one realizes that actually the transliteration, whereas for other terms, they actually change they describe the meaning of the term.
Right, yeah.
So, okay. like malicious speech, for example, they use it literally, the term is like double tongue.
Avoiding
malicious speech.
So
a little bit confusing.
Yeah. And Chinese is a very different language from Sanskrit. Chinese is not grammar, really, as I understand it. It's just the meanings are simple. So to actually to kind of get all the meaning into Chinese is very, very difficult. So sometimes it's very kind of slightly vague compared to the Pali, what it actually means. You kind of have to. Sometimes you, when Bernardo tells me, you actually have to have the Pali next to it to be able to sometimes figure out the meaning of the Chinese because it's too vague. You know?
Yeah, that's wrong. So,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. That's good. That's yeah.
Thank you very much, Adam.
Yeah. Next time, I'll learn. I'd actually really like to learn ancient Chinese. It would be really cool because then you have the you have both languages. You can do more comparative study and things like that.
I think
normal Chinese, is, modern Chinese is already like hard enough for Chinese speakers, let alone like the ancient Chinese as well. It's really quite tough.
Sure, yeah. But it depends on your motivation, you know. As a Buddhist monk, you have a lot of motivation. Mm-hmm. If you have a lot of motivation, things can become much easier.
That's true. Yeah.
If you go to school, it's really boring. Oh, you couldn't be bothered, you know.
Yeah. Is there anybody who's doing the translation of the Pali Canon into Hindi, for example? Because I'm aware that like in India now there's actually a pretty big population of like Buddhists, but it's a lot of mistaken Buddhism. Like they treat the Buddha as a god. Like it doesn't help that in like India right now, the Hindu
nationalists,
they tend to like view like the Buddha as a 13th incarnation of like Vishnu.
Yeah, that's unfortunate, isn't it? Yeah. I don't know. I'm not sure if there is one. Have you checked the Sutra Central? If there is a Hindi translation?
I don't think there is a Hindi.
There is no Hindi translation. They should really have one. They have it in Devanagari. They have the Pali Canon Devanagari
alphabet
there, so it's just in Pali. But they should really have a translation.
Because I'm just wondering whether that would help with the Buddhists in India right now.
Yeah, I'm sure it would. We're very useful about that. After a while, actually, there are a few Indians who actually go to Sutra Central there. Buddhist. When I was out, I did a retreat in Sri Lanka last, it was in June and July. Uh-huh. A couple of people came all from Delhi. Just to take part in a retreat in Sri Lanka. They're really keen. Okay. They're kind of basically at around disciples and things.
There's some that I've met on the Sutta class. So the Sutta class, that's the YouTube channel.
Right,
And there are all these people that are on it. One of them is this guy from Delhi, Shivam.
Shivam, exactly. he's really keen.
I think he
wants to become monk, actually.
Oh, really?
But it's wonderful. It's difficult. In India, it's just like with the Chinese, it's very hard to get your parents to allow you to.
I think it would be like the Rathapala Sutta.
The Pala Sutta, exactly. That's the way to go.
Objections to like share the recordings on platforms.
yeah, okay, yeah, that's fine.
But you can always go off shoulder. But we've never seen you off shoulder ever. You mean you have the option.
Okay.
So now we can do some the summarizing, a bit of kind of adding up what it all kind of comes out, what it really will be, all this gets us. And I think one of the most important things on this path, it's quite easy to understand what you have to do, right? It's not that hard. Okay, there is a lot of details that I have been giving about different stages of the path and all of these kind of things. But the basic ideas are actually quite simple. So keep it simple, right? Keep it easy. Remember that in the end, everything can really be summarized almost like in a single word, and that is kindness. Right? The whole thing can be summarized in that. And as long as you practice that in your life, then you know that you are on the right track. And this is really, so everything, you know, comes back to that, which is quite handy. So the most difficult thing on the path is not to understand what it is about. I think it's fairly straightforward. The hardest part is actually to really do it, really to be committed to it, to persevere, to do it moment after moment, day after day, week after week, year after year, sometimes lifetime after lifetime, right? Because you have to keep on doing this. This is the hardest part. So what I want to focus on now is a little bit how can we ensure that we do this for the long term and we don't kind of run out of steam, we keep inspired, we keep doing all the right things. That is going to be a little bit of the focus now, because this is often the hardest part. And to show you how this works, I'm going to have a quick look at another sutta. And this sutta shows you a causal sequence. Everything in Buddhism is causal sequences. One thing leading to another one, right? And this is one of those sequences. And it shows you where everything originates from, what it all actually comes from. I'm not sure if you have this sutta in your thing. I don't think you do, actually. But I think you should be able to get what I'm talking about here anyway. So the purpose of the Buddhist path, of course, is to find, eventually, to find the liberation from suffering, right? To eliminate all the delusion and actually see things in accordance with reality. This is the purpose of the path. So because that is the purpose, then you find suttas like this which show you what is the condition to actually get to that point. What is the condition for eliminating all delusion and to end suffering? And it takes that backwards, step by step, back and back and back and back, all the way to the very beginning, showing you what is the root cause for that liberation to happen. And this can be seen in many different ways, and this is just one of these frameworks that shows that. So, what is, this sort of talks about nutriment, what is the nutriment for the for liberation, right? For coming to the end of the path. I'm just going to skip all of that. Okay. So the nutriment for, what is the nutriment for liberation? And I'll just quickly go back through all of these nutriments because they're quite a nice way of understanding the whole structure of the Buddhist path, just an alternative way of looking at it. So the nutriment for liberation is the seven factors of awakening. I didn't mention those before. The seven factors of awakening are all about meditation practice, about samadhi specifically. How to get that peace of mind that enables you to kind of make that final breakthrough, right? So this fits with everything else we have seen on this retreat as well. What is the nutriment and the cause for those seven factors of awakening? And the answer is the four satipatthanas, the four right mindfulness, right? So seven factors of awakening is the eighth factor of the Noble Eightfold Path. The satipatthanas is the seventh one. Again, you can see the same structure we have been looking at throughout this retreat. So what is that all about? It's all about watching the breath, right? Satipatthana is equivalent to the breath meditation, especially when that becomes very peaceful and very beautiful. That breath meditation helps you to abandon the hindrances I was talking about before. Right? In fact, in this sutta, the Satipatthana and the factors of awakening are taught as the exact opposite of the hindrances. So this is how you abandon these things. Right? So then, the next thing, what is the cause for these for the Satipatthanas? And the answer according to this sutta is the three kinds of good conduct. So these three kinds of good conduct, again, this is the sort of things that we have been focusing on a lot, body, speech and mind, right? These are the causes for Satipatthana to actually work. So in other words, if you want to have success in your meditation on the breath or whatever it is, you have to have your conduct established first of all. This is something you see throughout the suttas. It talks about the two conditions for being able to do Satipatthana practice. Those two conditions are always, on the one hand, virtue, right, or character or conduct or whatever you want to call it. That's the one. And the second one is what they call ujjukaditti, which means straight view. So you have to have the right, a rough idea of what right view is in the world. And when you have those two things together, then meditation becomes possible. Right? It's very interesting and very important. Meditation really only comes from having already a lot of purity in your practice. Three kinds of right conduct, even mental conduct, has to be fairly good before it becomes possible. And you know that's true, right? If you have a lot of thinking going on, a lot of upset in your life, powerful desires, they're going to mess with your mind. They're going to carry you out. You're going to be looking at the future, at the past. You're going to be thinking about this, about that. And basically, it comes from these defilements. That is what is driving these things. So it's not bad. You shouldn't kind of judge yourself because of that, because this is what the vast majority of people are like that. It takes quite a special person to have regularly a peaceful mind. Not many people have that. Tiny minority only. So the three kinds of good conduct, right? These are the causes for mindfulness, to be able to meditate. So what is the cause for the three kinds of good conduct? It says here, restraint of the sense faculties. Right? Remember I was talking about that, talking about the gradual training and how restraint of the faculties is where you get this even mind, not allow your mind to be bossed around by aversions and desires. Right? And remember I was saying that a lot of that has to do with wisdom power. How you reflect on things, how you think about the world. This is by far the most important thing here. So as you keep on reflecting in the right way, in skillful ways, that sense restraint will tend to fall into place. Causes and conditions for sense restraint is mindfulness and full awareness. This we also had a look at before. And one of the points about mindfulness and full awareness is that you know the things in life that are suitable, right? Are suitable, conducive to being a good person, to doing the right thing. You don't put yourself into situations that make it difficult for yourself. Right? So this is, of course, one of the great things about being a monk or a monastic, is that usually, not when you come here perhaps, but usually you are in a suitable place for the practice. Here. This is also okay, as long as you know how to handle it, right? In the long run, this was definitely not the suitable for a monastic, because in the long run, it would kind of drag you away from what monastic life is like. But for a few days, it's okay. So you have that full awareness. You know where you hang out, what you're supposed to do, what is conducive to the practice. And then the sense restraint can happen as a consequence. Then what is the cause or the nutriment for clear awareness, and that is yoniso manasikara, careful attention or wise attention. Another word we have been talking about, right? You can see how all of these things we've been talking about and during the retreat, these are all core ideas of the Buddhist path, core concepts. And if you understand how they work, you can see how it all fits together really beautifully. It's like a jigsaw puzzle, all the pieces fitting together very nicely. So careful attention, yoniso manasikara, or wise attention, is this ability to know whether you're thinking in the right way or not. Right? If you're thinking wisely, it means you're moving towards more peace, moving towards good quality. If you're thinking unwisely, that you can see straight away if your mind is moving towards upset or anger, moving towards all these negative things, you know right there, you can see it, that there's some kind of unwise attention going on. You're looking at things in the wrong way. So again, this very crucial concept, yoni samanasikara, that you have to take with you all the way on the path, it develops as you go along here. Right? And we can see why this is so important at the kind of, we're coming close to the beginning here now, we can see why it is so important. Now, the next one, what is the cause and condition for wise attention? Right? Again, very interesting, how can we have wise attention? And the interesting thing here is that the cause for wise attention is faith, is confidence, conviction about the Buddha's teachings. Initially, usually in the world, unless we have some teaching we can rely on, unless we have somebody to help us point out the way, we don't really have any guidance, right, for where to look and how to think. It's very hard to understand these things for ourselves. Okay, the Buddha was able to do it through accidents of history, through, you know, getting it all together. But generally speaking, it's incredibly hard, difficult to see this. And this is why the vast majority of people in the world, they're just caught up in sensual pleasures, trying to kind of make the world be a nice place. And don't they lack that overall view of somebody who has stepped out of all of this and looked at it from the outside and seen what the real problem is. The Buddha being the eye of the world, right? He has above all of this, looking down, the eagle view, the perspective of everything. We haven't got that. We're just immersed in everything. And because of that, it's incredibly hard to see what is going on now. So faith and confidence is very interesting, is actually the cause for wise reflection. You have confidence in somebody, you look at them and you say, wow, this person, they are just so different. How can they be so different? How can they be so pure? You see the Buddha, no defilements. You see consistent kindness over long, long periods of time. You don't see any of those things that you see in ordinary people. And you think, whoa, this is just unreal. How can anybody be like that? And then you listen to the teaching, they are congruent with the way the person behaves. And then something happens inside of you. You get some conviction, feeling, yeah, this is it. This is really it. You know, this is what I've been looking for. This is what I would like to have in my life as well. And your beginning of that conviction, the beginning of confidence starts from that. Sometimes we think of wise reflection as, yeah, it's my personal wisdom. But initially, it's the wisdom of the Buddha, the wisdom of somebody outside who understands what's going on. Gradually, it becomes your own wisdom. As you practice the path, you see how it works, it becomes your own wisdom. Then it becomes far more powerful again, because then you know what's going on. Okay, so wisdom comes from faith, right? That's what it's saying here. Faith. First faith, and then wisdom arises from that. And it's important that this is an important aspect of the Buddhist path, the idea of faith and confidence. There are many things we cannot see for ourselves, and then it is appropriate to have some confidence in these teachings. So where does that faith come from? And it comes from hearing the good Dhamma. Right? You hear the sutta, you hear somebody who says something which is wise, in accordance with the Dhamma. The good Dhamma is a sub-Dhamma. So you hear that and you recognize there's something powerful going on here. Where does that hearing the good Dhamma come from? It comes from associating with good persons. Good persons here is Sapporisa, often translated as superior persons as well. So these are the people who are the Aryans in the world. Those people who have seen the teachings for themselves and who know what they are talking about. So when you hang out with the Sapporisa, right, then you are heading in the right direction. This is the root cause for everything else. This is where it starts. Without that, liberation is impossible. Right? Being with noble people, being with the Sapporisa, Sapporisa number one. Number one Kalyana, this is basically just another way of saying Kalyana Mitta, really. Number one is the Buddha himself. He's the one who started this whole path. He's the one without which all of Buddhism would just collapse like a house of cards because there's no foundation. The Buddha is the one that really matters. His view of the world, his understanding, is the one thing we have to take for granted. Everything else might be uncertain. Perhaps it isn't, but perhaps it is. So this is where it all stands. Right? And then it becomes kind of clear. This is the foundation. Hanging out with the Buddha, listening to the good Dhamma. How do you hang out with the Buddha then? Right? One way is to read the suttas. Remember what I was saying on the very first day about the idea that the Buddha, when he taught these suttas, he knew that there would be people like us listening to these teachings in the future. And because he knew that, he specifically formulated these things in such a way that they are quite universal. They are applicable to everybody. Sometimes, of course, a little bit of the local culture would have seeped in, otherwise people wouldn't be able to understand it. But generally speaking, these are very universal teachings, valid across cultures, valid across time, and that's why it is we can relate to these things with such ease, even in the present day. So he was thinking about us, right? So when you read the suttas, because he was thinking about us, you are literally, I would say, almost literally anyway, maybe not quite, but you are very near to being in the presence of the Buddha himself. Right? And when you think like that, it becomes very, whoa, this is just so remarkable, right? To be there. The Buddha was actually thinking about us. When I'm reading this, I know that he was thinking about us when he was speaking these words. And you feel the sense of this awesome power of these words. The Buddha is there, just behind them, and you are in his presence. Right? And this is how, and then you read the words, you take them far more seriously when you have that kind of feeling, right? Suddenly they become, whoa, they really come alive. And then you read them, you take them seriously. Because you take them seriously, you take them on board, you reflect on them much more. You don't sit there just listening to them and then afterward, oh yeah, now we'll go and enjoy ourselves. But you actually think about them for a while. What do they actually mean? How do they apply in my life? What does this mean to me? What does this mean for practical purposes? Make sure you don't theorize too much. These teachings are all about practice, all about being pragmatic, how we're supposed to live our lives, right? So remember that. And then you take them on board in the right way. And then they become incredibly meaningful for you in your life as a consequence. So, if the path isn't going fast enough for you, if you find it hard to commit, you find it hard to persevere in this practice, you have to go back to the source. Go back to the source. Hang out more with the Buddha. Listen to his teachings. Reflect on those teachings, right? And then that is the source for everything else to happen. And there's a beautiful simile that actually describes this. It's also in the sutta itself. I'll read the simile out to you because it's actually quite meaningful and nice. So this is the Buddha speaking, right? Again, so this is how the simile that he uses. I always find the simile and the suttas are very meaningful. Sometimes the other stuff can be a bit dry, but the similes really bring it to life. Just as when it is raining and the rain pours down in thick droplets on a mountaintop, the water flows down along the slope and fills up the clefts, the gullies, and the creeks. These becoming full fill up the pools. These becoming full fill up the lakes. These becoming full fill up the streams. These becoming full fill up the rivers. These becoming full fill up the great ocean. Right? Thus there is a nutriment for the great ocean. And in this way, it becomes fuller. So too, associating with the good persons, like with the Buddha, when that becomes full, it fills up the hearing the good Dhamma, and all the way back to the very top, filling up true knowledge and liberation. Right? So it's a matter of just allowing it to rain. Every drop matters. Every drop will add a little bit to the streams, and they will add again to the pools. And gradually, as you allow it to rain and rain and rain in your life, contemplating the Dhamma, reflecting on what it means, listening to suttas, going to hear a nice talk which inspires you and drives you forward, as you do that, everything fills up and fills up and fills up until eventually it reaches the ocean. Right? Until eventually you also get to Nirvana, you also get to the end of this path. That's all you have to do, man. So make sure you allow it to rain. Make sure that you contemplate these teachings enough, that you get enough input, And as you do that, you will actually be moving in this direction. Whether you want to or not, you will be heading that direction. You will be brainwashed, right? As I was saying on the very first day, you have no choice. Because you see that this is beautiful, this is right. You want to be brainwashed because you understand it's a good thing. Right? We are brainwashed anyway, as I was saying on the first day, because everything is really brainwashing. Brainwashing just means conditioning. You have no choice about brainwashing, so make sure you get brainwashed in a good way here. And then you will be heading in the right direction as a consequence. So this is what it means. Remember, I remember one of those famous Chinese sayings, right, which kind of get spread around these days, and they're saying that a journey of 1,000 miles starts with a single step. Right? And this is what this is. This is what this is like. Every drop is like one step, right? And you keep on filling it up, filling it up, filling it up, and eventually you get to that point where actually this works. So then, what happens once you start to really take this teaching seriously in this way? Then what happens? Of course, your mind inclines in that direction, and then you start to become committed. You start to persevere. You start to do all the basic things that are so important on this path, especially the idea of being kind, of being compassionate. And you start to understand that this idea of kindness is not to be taken lightly. It's not just about keeping the five precepts. As I say, of course, it's a wonderful thing to do and very powerful and very important. But it's so much more than that. And you start to understand that every moment matters. Because every moment you have the possibility of adding a drop to that mountaintop. Right? Every moment actually changes something in you. And it moves you closer to the goal. Moves you closer to where you want to be. So you start to take every opportunity. Because you realize it is so critical if you want to move forward on the path. So you have a chance to either say something nice or say something bad. And remind yourself, actually, I have this incredible power through my speech, either to make people miserable or to make them happy, or kind of neutral. But neutral is okay. Sometimes we have to say neutral things. But let me try to use this power that I have in my hands to actually do something good for the people around me. And you use that moment to moment. You take every opportunity. So you're always adding a bit of water to that stream, and you actually pushing yourself forward, right? Moving towards the ocean. And then you start to understand how crucial all of these things are. And the more you understand that, the more easy it is to be mindful in the present moment of what you're supposed to do. This is one of the most important and basic ideas of mindfulness, is just to have enough awareness in the present moment to know whether you're doing the right thing or not. Right? This also takes mindfulness. Sometimes we forget it, but that is kind of the basic idea. And if you have that degree of mindfulness, then already you're heading in the right way, going in the right direction. So remember this, and then things start to flow, right? Things start to go in the right direction. Then, as you build it up like this, making every moment important, every day important, it builds up and builds up. And then, when you come on a retreat next time, you find something has changed. Your mind is different, you're feeling more peaceful, you're getting more joy, and your meditation starts to work. Before meditation starts to work, meditation isn't that important. You can use it, you can do it to support you a little bit in your virtue, in your kindness, and all of these kind of things, but it's not going to give great results, right? But once all this foundation work is put into place, then the meditation really starts to work. And this is what the sutta is saying. You come to the Satipatthana. Actually, Satipatthana, mindfulness of breathing, is way up there. You're already getting quite close to kind of enlightenment when you get to that point. And all of these other things is what we have to do in the meantime. So, that is that beautiful sutta. It can be expanded on a lot because there's so much beautiful information in there. But one of the things that I wanted to do today is to also have a look at a couple of the suttas that I had left out earlier on. And when we talk about kindness and we talk about doing the right thing to people around us, then, of course, it is always important, but there are certain people that are more important in our life than others. Some of the people that are most important according to the suttas is, of course, your parents, right? Whether they are alive or whether they are dead, we can always do something for the past generations. So I want to just have a quick look at how this actually works out on the Buddhist path. One of the interesting things about parents is that in the standard formulation of what is right view on the Buddhist path, one of the things it says in there, and this is something you may have read, maybe you kind of just passed it by because you didn't know what it meant, but it says in the basic idea of right view, it says, there is mother and father. Right? I remember reading that and I thought, yeah, sure, of course there's mother and father, and I continued. Right? And this is the problem. We don't take the Buddha's teaching seriously enough. If it says in there, it must have some meaning, right? It's kind of, it doesn't just say that because it's too obvious otherwise. It must have some meaning. And of course, if you look at the context where it is spoken and all of these kind of things, you start to understand the context is all about karma and rebirth, right? So when it says there is mother and father, it must mean that there is very powerful karma to be made in connection with your parents. Right? And this is why we know this is true from the sutta as well, because one of the worst things you can possibly do is to kill your parents. Right? Oh, I want to get that inheritance more quickly, so you can let me just finish off the previous generation. Right? And that is really, really bad karma. You're greed and you are killing the people who have looked after you the most in your life is a terrible thing. That's why it's such a terrible thing to do that. So the karma you can make is very, very powerful in relation to your parents. And that is what that means. So because of that, just by doing what is right to our parents, we can actually enhance our practice a lot. This is actually becomes one of those things that makes the path much more powerful. What I want to do is have a look at a couple of these suttas that talks about parents and try to investigate how we can do this in a way so it doesn't become too burdensome and too difficult. Sometimes if you think, oh, I have to do all these things for my parents, you go, oh no, I don't really want to do that, it's too much, too hard work, I've got too much history with them, it's so hard, And sometimes that's true, we have a lot of history with our parents, sometimes it can be difficult. All kind of things come in the way. Some people have had very difficult upbringing. And for those who had a really difficult upbringing, you just try to move a little bit in the right direction. You don't set the bar too high. If you set the bar too high, you're going to make it almost impossible for yourself. So if you had a very difficult upbringing, sometimes if you can just forgive your parents for all the silly things they did, that's already really good. But for most ordinary people who have had a reasonably good upbringing, we need to think about our family and our parents in such a way that it makes it easier to support them, right? And this is one of those things that the Buddha does quite skillfully. So have a look at those suttas. This is actually in there. I was going to talk about this thing, but I haven't really gotten around to it yet. So this is one of the things that the Buddha says about parents. This sutta is called Brahma. It's from the Anguttara Nikaya 3. And this is what the Buddha has to say, right? Bhikkhus, monks, those families dwell with Brahma, where at home the mother and father are revered by their children. Those families dwell with the first teachers, where at home the mother and father are revered by their children. Those families dwell with the gift-worthy, where at home the mother and father are revered by their children. Brahma, monks, is a designation for mother and father. First teachers is a word for mother and father. Gift-worthy is a word for mother and father. For what reason? Mother and father are helpful to the children. They raise them, nurture them, and show them the world. Right? So this is how the Buddha describes parents. First of all, he compares them to Brahma. Now, Brahma in Buddhism, we know about the Brahma Viharas, right? The divine abidings, where you have metta and compassion and sympathetic joy and equanimity to all beings. These very beautiful abidings we talk about in Buddhism. So Brahma in Buddhism really refers to kind of very high qualities of mind. Specifically, it refers to metta and kindness. Right? So when the Buddha uses the word Brahma in this way, that dwell with Brahma. What he's saying is that you're supposed to look upon your parents in this way, as Brahma, as these people who have a lot of kindness towards you, right? And this, I think, is a very important thing to remember because of all the history we have with families, because there's bound to be bad experiences. Nobody is perfect. You always have some bad experiences, right? So because of that, it's important to remind yourself that actually the overall feeling that a parent has for a child is always one of looking after them, of caring, of having a sense of metta. Right? It's so important. You see this, of course, in the Metta Sutta itself. Just like the mother cares for her only child and loves her only child, so you should have a metta for all living beings. The exact interpretation of that phrase is a bit uncertain, but you get the rough idea of what is going on there. And this is one of the things you start to see when you look at people in the world. A mother, maybe even more mother than a father, but fathers too to some extent, you always have the ability, not always, but vast majority of the time, we have the ability to forgive. Right? If your child does bad things, okay, you might get a little bit upset, but then you forgive afterwards. And this is the power of being a mother. You always have this ability to forgive your child, even if they go to prison, even if they do really stupid things, still you will forgive. Still, you will love that child to a high degree. Why is it? What is it about a mother or a father that enables them to forgive like that? And the reason, I think, is quite straightforward. The reason is that a mother and a father, they are always able to see the goodness in that child. They have brought them up right from they were young and innocent to they become rebellious teenagers. But they have seen a lot of goodness in that person over the years. And because they are able to see the goodness, they're always able to see behind the facade of the bad qualities and see deeper into that person and see the positive qualities. And that is why I think a mother and a father usually are able to forgive their children. Right? So this is why it is so powerful. And in exactly the same way, when we remember that, when we remember that this is one of the powers of our parents, sometimes it's not obvious because they may not say these things to us. It may not come out into the open. But all we have to do is to remember that that is the reality behind that. And we know that because we know from experience around the world that that is exactly how these relationships work out. And there's a lot for us to be learned from that, not only to be learned in terms of how we treat our parents, but also how to treat people generally. If a mother is able to see the goodness in her child, regardless of what they do, it means we can do the same. Right? We also have that ability to just remind ourselves, and this is one of those, again, interesting teachings in the sutta, that we have had all kinds of relationships with everyone in the world. We have been everybody's mother at some stage, everybody's father at some stage. So because we have that relation with everyone, if we are wise, we're able to recall that actually those good qualities are there in every one of these beings that we have been the mother of in the past. And then you turn your attention, you start to think like your mother, and you start to see the good qualities in the people around you. Just like I was talking about before, remembering that people are complex, there are always good qualities there that you can turn to. And this is one way of doing that, right? Remember, what is it like to be a mother? And then you can see these things much more easily. So when you start to turn your attention like this and remember the big picture of who your parents are, then the little things in life start to fade into the background. Okay, sometimes they did strange things, sometimes they weren't fair, and all of this kind of stuff, but the overall picture is still very powerful, very beautiful. So you're learning here again to change your perceptions. Look at things in a different way. And as you do that, you enable yourself to give back to your parents with a sense of metta, with a sense of understanding. And then it becomes easy to look after your parents, rather than being a chore and a burden. I know, of course, all of these things about filial piety, right? This is a little bit stronger in Asia than it is in the West. So sometimes people say, oh, this burden, I have to look after my father and mother. Don't think like that. Think that it in the right way, and it becomes a joyful and positive experience then. Okay. Then we have the second one, right? Those families dwell with the first teachers. The first teachers is a designation for mother and father. And again, this just underscores and adds to the first point that they are your first and most important teachers. You would not be able to look after yourself without all the input from your parents. They have taught you all the basic things in life, how to clean yourself, how to dress, how to get up in the morning, how to eat, right? All of these things comes from your parents, all the basic things that we learn. These are far more important than the education that you get at university or whatever, isn't it? Right? Because it's kind of more fundamental to know these basic things. So, and they have looked, made sure that you are equipped to function in the world. The most important teachers are our parents. And again, remember that. And they do that because they love you, because they look after you, because of all of these things. And again, once you see that, you understand that there's always a debt of gratitude towards our parents. The last one, those families dwell at home with the gift word, because the gift word is a term for parents. And this again is a very interesting point. Why is it that somebody is gift-worthy? And the reason is because they have given something to us, and then we should return that gift, right? Return something to them. That is what makes them gift-worthy. In the suttas, the people who are called gift-worthy is the Buddha and the Aryas and the Arahants. These are the people that are called gift-worthy. Why? Because they have the ability to give a much more powerful gift to us. The gift of the Dhamma, the gift of true happiness, the gift of personal transformation. And in return, they become gift-worthy, so we support them in return in the right way. And here, the parents are compared to those Aryas, compared to the Arahants of the world, right? They are put on the same level, basically, in terms of gift-worthiness. Just as the bad karma you can make from killing your parents is equivalent to killing an Arahant, in the same way, that they are gift-worthy in the same way on the positive side. Right? So again, very powerful, on the same level as the Arahants, as the enlightened, perfected beings of the world. So, these are just aids to help us to look at our parents in a new way, to be able to forgive the little things, right? When you go, it's always funny, when I go back to visit my parents, it's like I never grew up. You know, you're still the same child we were before. I'm sure you can know to some extent what I mean, because there is certain habits, certain ways of relating that will never change, it will always be like that. So what you have to do is you have to kind of transcend that and say, okay, whatever, it doesn't matter, it's irrelevant, the big picture is what matters. I'm not going to allow myself to be irritated by these kind of silly little things from the past. So this is how you transcend that, by thinking in this way here, because you're seeing a different picture, your perception is changing, right? And this is what makes it possible then to deal with your family and your parents in a new way. And this is also the answer to that other question that people were talking about. How do you actually help your parents? Right? If you're able to transcend all the silliness, all the stupidity, all the pettiness in life, and show that you are larger than all of that, that you are kind of gone beyond all of that, then your parents will take note. And when they take note, there is much more chance that they will listen to you. And in fact, the Buddha says that this is precisely, and this comes in the next sutta, I'll read it out in a second, this is precisely how we can repay our parents, right? By showing them the Dhamma, showing them something more, showing them some kind of profound happiness that will lead to their long-lasting happiness and benefit in the future, not just in this life, but also in future lives. This is how we can do that. And that is enabled through our conduct. Our conduct is the most important thing here. Okay, so that is just how to learn, how to perceive things in a good way here. So let's have a look at the second one, which is kind of drive this home as well. Bhikkhus, monks, there are two persons that cannot easily be repaid. What two? One's mother and father. Even if one should carry about one's mother on one shoulder and one's father on the other, and while doing so they should live for 100 years, right? And if one should attend to them by anointing them with balms, massaging and bathing and rubbing their limbs, and they even void their urine and excrement right there, one would still not have done enough for one's parents, nor would one have repaid them. even if one were to establish one's parents as the supreme lords and rulers over this great earth, abounding in the seven treasures, one would still not have done enough for one's parents, nor would one have repaid them. For what reason? Parents are of great help to their children. They bring them up, feed them, and show them the world. Right, so it really goes into detail. They're basically saying that in terms of material things, it is that, you know, you cannot really repay them through material things. Of course, the reality is that we are repaying our debt a little bit by doing that. So this is a minimum of what we should do anyway. Treat them well, be kind to them, support them in whatever way we can. This is just kind of a really putting the idea of support, you know, to the maximum. You carry one on one shoulder, the other one on the other shoulder, and you walk around for you. This is kind of the idea of maximizing the support here. So material things can never really repay fully, but of course that's part of it, and it's a very important part of it, and how we treat them, generally speaking. But the debt of gratitude is more than that. So how then do we actually repay that debt of gratitude? And this is the next part here. But monks, if when one's parents lack faith, one settles, encourages, and establishes them in faith. If when one's parents are immoral, one encourages, settles them, and establishes them in virtuous behavior. If when one's parents are miserly, one encourages, settles, and establishes them in generosity. If when one's parents are unwise, one encourages, settles, and establishes them in wisdom. In such a way, one has done enough for one's parents, repaid them, and done more than enough for them. So this is the way, right? That you actually encourage them in those things that actually have a real significance, a real impact on your life, or on their life. This is where the difference is. Because these things are things they carry with them, not just in this life, but also in the future. So these are the things that are very expansive, very powerful, and they have incredibly long-term impact. So, but of course, the hard part is how to do this, right? And this is what you will often find. It is not easy. It takes a lot of perseverance, a lot of dedication, just to be able to help your parents in this way. Because very often they will not be interested or listen and all these kind of things. But if you are, do things in the right way, if you are wise about this, it can be done. That is my personal experience. You really have to be careful how you go about it, but it can be done if you do it in the right way. Don't push it. Don't try to get them to do what you think is right, but be very, very patient with them. And gradually, they will come around when they see, when they understand for themselves that there's something very powerful going on here. So this is how then we can start to look at our parents in a different way. And by doing that, we can take away some of what might seem like a burden or otherwise. And this is a very, obviously, makes it so much easier to do what is right. So, there you are. That is just underlying again this idea of the power of kindness, the power of doing the right thing in the world. So remember this. One of the things that, one of the sutta, and I was just mentioning this before on the retreat, that kind of makes all of this kind of, for me, come together very nicely. The importance, why these things are so important, is to remember this thing that when we invest in something in the world, we want to invest where there is real return, right? And sometimes it may be that on the spiritual path we feel that, actually, I don't know if there's any real return in this spiritual thing, I'm not feeling all that change, right? And sometimes it's easy to do all the worldly things and think that that will actually make your life much better. But the reality is, as you start walking the spiritual path, you start to see, number one, that even in this life, all of these spiritual things that we do, these are the things that give real quality to our lives. Yes, you can be wealthy, yes, you can be famous, all of these kind of things. But if your mind is a mess, right? The mind is what is closest to you. If the mind is a mess, it's not going to make that much difference. Right? And we see this all the time in the world. We see people who have all these things that seem to be great, and yet still they do crazy things like committing suicide. Why? Because the inner life isn't working out. It's only the external things that are working out. So we know, I think, intuitively here, that it is the spiritual path, even in this life, it is far more powerful than all the other external things. But even more important, and this is where the whole idea of rebirth and this extended samsara comes in. Remember the simile of the borrowed goods, right? And this is why, once we start to have some faith in that, and this faith, again, comes from reading the suttas, looking at the word of the Buddha, listening to people who have some experience with this, right? And you think, well, if the Buddha said this, gee, it must mean something. He doesn't say things just because, you know, he's not just making up stories or whatever. These are real issues. So you take it on board, and then you think about the consequences of that. And the consequences are that your entire outlook for what matters in this world, this changes completely. Instead of focusing your energies on this little life, everything is about this life, you start to understand that the stakes are much higher than that. There is this enormous, potentially endless expanse into the future and into the past. The past doesn't matter so much, but into the future. And that is how you should invest for the future in the right way. The future and now cannot come together like that. It gives you happiness in the present moment, and also it ensures that there is a future which is much brighter for you. So this is where this idea of right view comes in, right? This idea of looking at things in the right way is also very important. And actually, it so happened that this little passage on right view was another one that I had intended to read out, which I never really got around to. So this is, maybe have a very quick look at that one as the very last thing we do on this retreat. Is that a good idea? Right view, kind of ending it up. It's supposed to be first, right? Right view. Now if we are ending with right view, that's okay. These factors are, that kind of works out anyway. So this is what he says. And how, householders, are there three kinds of mental conduct in accordance with Dhamma? Righteous conduct. So the first one is not to have too much desire to covet the belongings of others. The other one is not to have kind of really strong ill will, right? May these beings die, that kind of ill will. And the last one, oh, that's literally what it says in there, it's really kind of very strong. And the last one is right view. Right? And this is the kind of definition of ordinary right view. He has right view, undistorted vision. Right? The vision is undistorted. It means that you're seeing things, your way of looking is aligned with the things, the way things actually are. And it goes like this: there is what is given, what is offered, and what is sacrificed. There is fruit and result of good and bad actions. There is this world and the other world. There is mother and father. There are beings who are reborn spontaneously. There are good and virtuous recluses and Brahmins in the world, who have themselves realized by direct knowledge and declare this world and the other world. So this is this idea of undistorted vision. It's called right view because it aligns with the way things actually are. And as I said before, if your view does not align with reality, you are climbing uphill, you're going against the wind, you are actually trying to live a life which is not in accordance with how things are. And for that reason, you will never find the happiness. You'll always be suffering because of that. And of course, of these views, the most basic one is this idea that there are good, virtuous recluses and Brahmins in the world who have realized by direct knowledge this world and the other world. Right? This is what faith in the Buddha is all about. You understand that there are such people as Buddhas in the world. You understand that there are disciples of the Buddha who practice in the right way. And because you have that understanding, or at least that confidence and faith, you may not fully know it yet, but you have some confidence in that, that is called right view or right belief. Without that, you don't even get started, right? That's why the majority of people in the world, they don't follow this kind of teachings. They go a different way because they are lacking that sense that there is something very important going on here. So this is the first thing. And it comes last, but this is really the basic one. And then you have the other ones, right? There is what is given, what is offered, what is sacrificed. The idea that generosity is an incredibly important part of the Buddhist path, right there among the right view. Generosity is so important because it has a very powerful ability to make us feel happy about ourselves. When you give something from your heart, you just hand it out to other people, very often you get straight away, you feel a sense of joy from that. So generosity can be very, very powerful. So please don't underestimate that. It's often not about the size of the gift, right? Often it can just be small little things. So open up your heart to all the people in the world that need your support. Like a beggar on the street, right? Sometimes just give them something small because they're obviously suffering and have a difficult life. Right? There's so many opportunities when you start looking around. You go to your office, you bring a cup of coffee to your fellow worker, right? You say something kind. The potential for generosity is just absolutely enormous once you start to take the opportunities. So again, the fact that it is here in right view means that it is really significant and really important. There is fruit and result of good and bad actions. Again, this is true in terms of rebirth, but it's also true in terms of life right here and right now. So focus on how this is true in the here and now. Do good. Feel the consequences straight away. There is this world and the other world, right? There is rebirth. That's what it's saying, really. You go from here and you move on to another one. And that is one, at the very last sentence there, this is what those virtuous recluses and Brahmins, what they declare is precisely this. There is this world and the other world. There is mother and father, there you have it again. There are beings who are spontaneously, who are reborn spontaneously. And this is just the idea that karma and rebirth is much more vast than we think it is. When you understand this fully, you also have to take into account that we are spontaneously arisen beings, because it expands the scope for happiness and suffering in the world. This body, you can only experience so much happiness with this body, but if you have one of these spontaneously arisen bodies, right, then all kind of other things are possible, which otherwise wouldn't be possible. You can also have so much pain in this body, because if you have too much pain, you just die, and that's it. So there's a limit to the pain as well, and the happiness. So that is, there you are, that is right view. Again, one of those very basic things on the Buddhist path that you need to take with you to understand where are the priorities of this world, what are the things that are really important again. So take these teachings, take them back with you, and when you go back, remember the basics, right? Forget a lot of the things I have said, you can just leave it at the back of your mind. But come down to the foundational practices. What is really important to do in my life? And it always really comes back down to this one thing here. If there's one single word that you should remember in a practice, just remember kindness. It summarizes the whole Buddhist path in a very beautiful way here. You may remember one of the very famous teachings of the Buddha is called the Ovada Patimokkha. It's found in the Dhammapada. And it says in there that to do no evil, but to do good, and to purify the mind. This is the teaching of the Buddha. Right? I'm sure you've heard that teaching many times before. This is the teaching of the Buddha. That whole thing, that whole line, can be summarized in that single word, which is just kindness. And everything comes from there. Okay, so go enjoy, have a good time, do all the right things, and you'll have a really nice life. So this is the end of this retreat. So before we make an end of it, let's just pay homage to Buddha Dhamma Sangha. Let's maybe do the Arahant for once, because it's quite nice to do, and then we'll have lunch or whatever afterwards.
Satipanno bhagavato savakasa.
Sangam Namami.
So far, everyone who attempted to retreat, I would like to thank you.